Memphis, Tennessee.
My name is Frank Marion, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm honored to be here. I want to thank Kevin, the board, Danis, Glenda Lee and Tom, and of course our voice, Leanne, for some beautiful thoughts and a really outstanding weekend. Here I am standing in a chapel, the church, your cross, candles, an altar behind me. And it reminds me one thing that I learned a long time ago, that I should never confuse my religion with my AA. They're two separate things, completely separate. And I mean no disrespect to religion, because I've had a lot of experience in religion. But AA is something, well, let me express it this way. I think sometimes that religion is the retailer or the wholesaler of the message, but in AA we buy direct. I'm reminded of a woman, an elderly woman who was rushed to the hospital with chest pains, a good person. And the doctor told her, he said, this is going to be a serious operation, your heart. He said, it could go this way or that way, I don't know. Are you ready? And she said, well, there's one thing I've got to do. And he said, what is that? She said, I got to write two checks. And he said, no. He said, you don't have time for that. No, I got to write two checks. And so he waited while he brought her purse, and she got out her checkbook and wrote her checks, and before he's wheeling her into surgery, he said, may I ask what those checks are for? She said, well, I wrote a check to pay the property taxes on my house, and I wrote a check to continue my tithing in the church. And he said, well, why is that so important right now? And she said, well, no matter how this operation comes out, I know I've got a home to come back to. And then later, after she recovered from surgery, the doctor was talking to her about her tithing, and she said, I know I can't take it with me, but it occurred to me it would be a good idea to send a lot or a little on ahead. I think Tom hit it last night when he said it's in the doing, and he said that in many different ways. It's in the doing. I'm reminded of the alcoholic who went to heaven, a good AA, and as he went through the gates, he looked around, and here he saw this large wall with shelves, and he looked at the shelves, and he said, well, what are those things? They look like dried mushrooms. And St. Peter said, no, he said, they're not dried mushrooms. He said, those are ears. And he said, well, what are you doing with all those ears? And he said, we have a lot of good people down there that go to church regularly. He said, they listen. And he said, they listen, and they listen, and they listen, but they never do anything. And he said, so when they pass on, he said, we feel out of respect, we at least ought to put their ears in here. And that's, they're not here, but their ears are. He said, we got a few AAs there, but not many. He said, not many. My sobriety date is August 15th, 1967, and I have my last drink on August 12th, or 13th, or 14th, so I know the 15th is really clean, and I haven't had a drink or a mind-bending pill since that day, by the grace of God, one day at a time, and you people and Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm also reminded of the AA who died and went to heaven, and he's standing in the line, and the master teacher, my higher power, whom I think of as a master teacher, I choose to call him God, is standing there at a gate with a checkboard, and he looks up, and all of a sudden he sees that Mother Teresa of India is standing right in front of him. And he overhears the master say, "But you could have done more." So it's in the doing of it. It's in our daily lives, what we do with our AA experience, how we share it, when we share it. It's all in the doing of it. My favorite step is the third step, because I guess it was so difficult for me to understand it. And it's beautiful, it's simply written, and you might, well, why can't you? It was difficult for me, and it's still my favorite step today. And I don't mean to say that it is more important than any step. They're all important, and they're all intertwined, and we know that. And we know you got to work them all, and we know you got to work them in order. 1, 2, 3, 4. I have three daughters. Whom I have an excellent relationship with them, and I love them. We talk frequently. And today, you know, with this computer age, the telephone's going out of style. You do it by email. And when I walk into my office in the morning and turn on the computer, and bloop, up comes the email, and I got a message from Annie on the Washington and one from Katie in Wisconsin. And I just love it. But a few years ago, when Katie was in a freshman year in college, and she hated college, she was struggling with it, she called me one night about 8 o'clock, and she said, "Daddy, I'm really desperate." She said, "I've said the Serenity Prayer 1,000 times. And she said, "I'm failing calculus." She said, "I got a D at midterm, and I failed every quiz since then." She said, "I got to take a final exam tomorrow morning, and I know I'm going to fail it." And she said, "It's going to set me back." And she said, "I can't stand it. I just simply can't handle it anymore." And I said, "Look, Katie," I said, "here's what you do. Before you go to bed tonight, you take that calculus book and throw it under the bed as hard as you can. And when you get on your knees to say your prayers, you tell God to take that calculus thing. And it's a problem, and you tell God to handle it." And I said, "Katie, God's going to be up all night anyway. He'll take care of it." And I went to bed, and I knew that things would work out the way they're supposed to work out, and I can't solve my kids' problems. I can't solve mine most of the time either. But the next evening, about 8 o'clock, Katie called. Collect. And she said, "Daddy," she said, "you can't believe what happened." I said, "Well, tell me, Katie." "Well," she said, "I passed." I said, "Great." But she said, "That's not the miracle." I said, "It was a miracle. Tell me about this thing." "Well," she said, "I did just what you told me to do. I turned the problem over to God. I went to sleep. The calculus book is still under the bed." And she said, "I walked in there at 8 o'clock in the morning." And she said, "Everyone was terrified. There were 60 or 70 students in that class, and the professor walked around giving out the examinations. And she said, I was trembling so hard I could hardly pick up my pencil. And the professor went to the head of the classroom, and she said, Daddy," she said, "all of a sudden the bells went off in the building, and a loudspeaker came on, and they said, you must evacuate the building, do it orderly. And everyone walked out on the lawn, and the police came, and the fire engines came, and there was a rumor there was a hidden bomb in the building or something." And she said, "We couldn't get back in the building for 4 hours. And later that afternoon, I went up to look and see what had happened, and the professor had a big sign on his door saying, the examination is canceled. We simply cannot schedule it at this late date, and I have taken your grades to this date and calculated it, and this is what your grade will be." And there was a list, and Casey went down with her social security number, and there it was. She got a B. A B. And she said, "Daddy, you don't suppose God came down and was fooling around with that guy's grade book?" I said, "I don't think so, Katie, but I tell you what," he said, "if he had, I wouldn't be that surprised. Don't worry about it." I do want to share one other thing before I get into my story. Three summers ago, I was in the Solomon Islands, in a very remote island of the Solomon Islands. We flew over to Fiji, and then we took a small plane in the Aniara Guadalcanal, which is the capital, and then we took a little puddle jumper into this very remote island, where there was no electricity, there was absolutely nothing, and the people there didn't wear shoes. And I was over there with some guys to help build a church. And as I say, I'm not really comfortable in a church setting. I'm not. I realize I'm in a church this morning, but we're talking AA. And so they asked me after about 10 days if I wouldn't speak at one of their little church meetings. And it was a thatched place with a open air, the sea breeze coming through. And I didn't want to do it, but with the AA background, you do what you're asked to do, and you do it to the best of your ability, and then you turn it over to God and say, God, I'm in your, take me along. And so I agreed to do it, and I was walking down this jungle trail to get into the place, and not quite sure, and I said, well, my favorite step in AA is step 3, and maybe I could talk about that, but there was no alcoholics, and they'd never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they wouldn't know what I'm talking about. So I said, well, I got to rephrase this thing so they understand it. And I picked up 3 coconut shells, and they get the coconuts out of the trees, they slice them in half, and they eat the coconut, and they throw the shell, and the place is littered with shells. I got 3 coconut shells. And I wanted to explain this thing, how I live my life as a Christian, if you will, or if I happen to be a Muslim that day, as a Muslim, I'm comfortable. And I put the 3 coconut shells on the front of the little podium like this, and I explained that the way I had to live my life to keep my sanity was that I would write down a problem, and if it was a personal problem that I could solve, I put it in the first coconut. And if it was a problem somebody else could solve, I put it in the second coconut. And if it was a problem only God could solve, I put it in the third coconut. I said, now, each morning when I get up, I could take one problem out of my coconut, work on it, whatever. Sometimes, but not too often, if it's another person, I might pull it out and look at it and say, well, maybe I could help with this problem, although it's up to somebody else. I says, I never pull those problems out of the third coconut. Now, they all spoke pidgin English, and so I had to explain this very slowly, and they were with me all the way, and they got it, and they were smiling and nodding their heads, and I thought, wow, I'm on a roll. So I thought one more thing before I sat down, and I remembered an AA fable that I'd heard many years ago. And this new guy in AA was struggling with a third step, really struggling. And he went to his sponsor and he said, yeah, it's really difficult for me. He said, this business is self-will run riot. You know, he says, it's like a black dog in my gut. He said, it's there. And he said, this idea of taking a third step, he said, it's like a white dog in my gut. And the two of them are fighting, and there's blood all over the place. Which dog do you think will win, the black dog or the white dog? And the wise sponsor said to him, which dog do you feed the most? And that's really what it's all about. Well, I told this story to my friends, and in a way that they could comprehend it, but I used the good and evil symbol. And they didn't seem to grab that like they grabbed the coconuts. And afterwards, one of the guys who'd been in the islands for quite a few years came to me and he said, you know, he said, you should never have talked about those dogs fighting, particularly a black dog. And I said, what's wrong? He said, well, the English colonized the Solomon Islands and they referred to the natives as black dogs. And I said, oh, good heavens, I didn't know anything about that. Well, he said, it's culture. He said, how would you know about that? So I was really desperate. I thought immediately, I said, God, solve this thing. I hurt these people's feelings out of my lack of knowledge. And later that day, I bumped into the chief, and he was talking to me, a very serious, big, big man, and big this way, as well as this way and this way. And he told me that he liked the coconuts. And then he said, but the dogs. He said, the dogs. He said, I don't. I said, I made a mistake. I said, it's a red dog. I said, there's a white dog and a red dog. And I said, like the red dog that runs wild in the jungle here, the wild dog. Oh, he said, the wild dogs, the red dogs. And they have wild dogs that are red, and they run in the jungles in New Guinea and the Solomons. Then he understood it. He said, oh, that's a good story. He says, I understand now. I understand. It's nothing to do with the English. I said, no, I don't mean, I said, I'm Irish. I don't like the English. I don't say anything like that. You know, just one more thing before I get into my story, and I'm watching my clock here. But Kevin said I had till 11:30. That's not true. Jerry and I were walking the other day, and we walked down the road near a couple of horses, and Jerry said, I don't take too kindly to horses, and I said, well, I walked over to the horses, and they came over and nuzzled me, and I knew they were looking for a piece of sugar, an apple, and I talked to the horses for a minute, and then we were walking back, and I started thinking about a horse, and it occurred to me, you know, the Kentucky Derby, and I said, you know, what if a guy had a $1 million horse, and you had to turn that $1 million horse over to someone? Would you just walk down the street and give it a $1 million horse to the next guy you know? You wouldn't do that. You'd find a good stable. You'd know about the person you're giving the horse to. You'd know all about the person you're giving the horse to, turning it over. What if you had a dog, a $100 dog that you love, a good $100 dog, and you had to turn that dog over to someone? You'd certainly find out something about that person before you turn that dog over, right? What about a $1 billion body? Wouldn't you want to know something about this higher power you turn it over to? I had to find out before I could turn it over. And that was my journey. It seems like we have three leads, you know, the one that you give when you're driving here, the one you give here, and the one you're driving home. But I got a fourth one, and that was the one I gave last night about 1:30 in the morning when I couldn't sleep. And the best one will probably be when I'm driving home. The third step is, to me, the hinge. It's the linchpin. It all opens up. Once you got that down solid, then the other nine steps reinforce this thing called spirituality. And what we're all doing for attended sobriety is to live on a spiritual basis. That's in the big book. Get our lives on a spiritual basis. Now, it also says there are no saints among us. And that's true. We're human. But we come here as a human, we have a spiritual experience, so we're a human with a spiritual experience, and over the years, we become a spiritual being with a human experience. A spiritual being with human experiences, and we turn those over to God. Those we can't solve, the experiences. The third step, to me, is like being on the 10-yard line, 90 yards to go, but we got the greatest quarterback in the world. The universe, the master teacher. And as long as we follow the play, we'll get to the touchdown. I'm thoroughly convinced of that with every morsel of my body. I was raised in Montana. Now, everybody doesn't love Montana, but as a boy, I absolutely loved Montana, and I had an idyllic boyhood. There was nothing in my boyhood that suggested future alcoholism that I could relate to. I never saw alcohol abused in my family. There was always alcohol there. There was always liquor. There was always whiskey on the cupboard. There were family gatherings where liquor was served. There were wakes when somebody died. There were weddings, and it was served. And I never saw it abused, and I never saw a drunken fight. Now, that's a true story. And I felt that Montana was the entire world. I could go to the north, and I could cross the Milk River and go up through Medicine Hat into the sweet grass country all the way to Calgary, and wouldn't be any people to bother me, and it was beautiful and free, and there was great sky. Or I could go to the west to the Rocky Mountains. Clear streams, beautiful, beautiful country. Or to the south was the Judith Basin and the Musselshell. And I thought there was no place. I thought, this is God. This is God, and this is God's country. I believed it to the bottom of my soul. If you went east, and I couldn't figure a guy going too far east, you finally had to cross the Powder River and then go on into the Dakotas and Wyoming. And I couldn't figure anybody doing that. Maybe Sam or Tom shouldn't have gone to South Dakota. And then my life progressed. The one dream I had was to play football for the Blue Ponies in Haver High School. That's all I wanted in life. I might say that everybody didn't love Montana. You talk to my wife about Montana, and she says, yeah, Montana. She says, you got to go there after Memorial Day because it's snowing, and you got to get out by Labor Day because it's snowing. My grandfather used to tell a story about the traveling salesman in the early days who was driving across Montana, and his car broke down on a very dusty road, and he had to walk back through the dust and the heat. It was 105 degrees in July, and he came to this little place 3 miles away and told the fellow that his car broke down, and he said, have you got anything to eat? And the fellow said, well, he said, it's after 2 o'clock. We serve dinner at 12 around here. I think we got a little sage hen in the kitchen. We fix you. The guy says, what's a sage hen? Well, he said, it's prairie chicken. He said, it grows wild. We shoot them, eat them like a grouse. The salesman said, well, is it got wings? He said, yeah. He says, can it fly? He says, yeah. He said, listen, anything that's got wings and can fly and stays in Montana, I don't want it. But this was my dream, and I was arrogant. As a kid, my father and I were just like this, pushing all the time, pushing. Now, I respected him, I loved him, but somehow I wanted him out of the way. If I don't really explain that emotion. So in May, when I was 13 years old, my father and mother came to me and told me my father got a wonderful promotion and the whole family was going to move down to the Black Hills of South Dakota. And I said, you got to be crazy. There's no way I'm leaving. I'm not going. Absolutely not. And we fought and argued and argued and fought. And I told him before I went there, I'd move out on Beaver Creek and live in the Rocky Boy Agency with the Indians. And I was determined not to go. Well, as a 13-year-old kid, I finally went. And I took one look at that town of Rapid City, and there were over 25,000 people there, and I'd been living in a town with 4,000 people, which I thought was too big, because I like to go off by myself and sit on a rock. And I thought, this is terrible. I said, this place isn't even healthy with all these people and the cars and the traffic. And I was 13, I had to go into high school, and I took one look at that high school, and I said, well, I'll show him. I said, I'm going to blow out this thing so fast. I'm going to go through this thing like fighting fire. And I enrolled in high school, and I finished in 3 years rather than 4. Just sheer determination and anger to get out. And I always had this dream of playing football, and my father came to me in my last year of high school, and he said, you're really warped, kid. He said, all you do is work. He said, you're not a well-rounded person. He said, you ought to do something. Why don't you go out for football? And so I thought about it, and I had this dream then right away. I would go out for football, get a letter sweater. I'd buy 3 letter sweaters, give one to my sister, I'd keep one. And there was this real pretty girl that would smile at me every time I saw her in the hall. And I overheard her once saying she really wanted a letter sweater from some guy that played football. So I went out for football. I worked my tail off with the same intensity that I did everything else, arrogant, convinced there'd be no problem. And it came down to the final game. We're playing Deadwood, South Dakota, which was supposed to be a gimme. The score was 13-7. And I had gotten 11 quarters, and you had to have 12 to get a sweater. And I'm sitting on the bench, and the ticking away, and it's 2 minutes left, and the coach, who I always thought was senile anyway, whirled around, and a kid came running out of the field, the huddle, and he had his teeth in his hands, And he said, right by me. And he stopped and he said, Prunty, left guard, go. And little Prunty weighed 130 pounds. He'd never played left guard in his life. He was an end. And Prunty said, who, me? He said, I don't play guard. And the coach blew his stack. He said, get in there. And Prunty ran in and boom, the game's over. And I had 11 quarters and I didn't get a sweater. And I was really upset, really angry. And I really rub it in. A week later, my father met the coach on the street, and the coach apologized, and he said, I got so rattled. He said, I wanted to send Frank in there, and I knew he wanted his letter. And my father said, oh, that's all right. The kid, he doesn't need a letter. It's fine. And my father told him, it's not so right. So anyway, I finished high school at 16 and went right into college. Right into college at 16 years of age, got involved in a fraternity. The president of the fraternity was a former major in the Army Air Corps. They're all older guys. And I made a decision I was going to blast right through that college like I did high school, and then I was going to go back to Montana. And I said, I'd be happy driving a gravel truck. I want to get away from all these people. But I got to Boulder, Colorado, and I looked up at the Flatirons, which are gorgeous, and I looked back over to the west, and there were the Rockies, and I said, this can't be too bad. And within 2 or 3 weeks, they started having these parties for fraternity kids, you know, and the kid came up to me and he said, Frank, he said, would you like a beer? And I said, well, what would that be? And he said, well, it's a Slitz. And I said, well, I'm a Grain Belt man. I drink Grain Belt beer. And I'd never had a glass of beer in my life, but my grandfather used to take me down through Montana every summer to the ranch, and we'd stop in these saloons on the way to get a drink of water. He'd check the water. He carried a German Luger in the glove compartment, which he called the whiskey box, and he carried a 22 special on the back seat with a tin cup, and he'd check the water all the way across Montana to see how it was for cattle. And we'd walk into a saloon, and I was a little kid, and he had a big hat on and boots, and we'd walk up to the bar, which was in the end, a big mahogany bar, and he'd look down at me and he said, what are you drinking, Frank? And I'd say, I guess a Coca-Cola. And he'd say, give my grandson a Coca-Cola, I'll have a Grain Belt beer. Well, a week passed, and I went to another one of these parties, and a guy came up, and he said, would you like a beer? You know, and I said, well, what would that be? He says, I don't know. It's in a keg over there. It's a glass of beer. So I said, oh, all right. And I had that glass of beer, and then I went over and sat down beside the keg, and I spent the afternoon drinking beer. And I thought it was pretty good. And I became very talkative. I could talk to pretty girls. I could move around. I could tell war stories. I'd never seen a war. I was doing pretty good. And the next day, I wasn't that sick. Some of the guys were dropping around, you know. I had a slight headache, a little tired. Well, that was the beginning of my drinking career. That was the beginning. I had high tolerance for alcohol. I drank a lot. I didn't seem to have any difficulty with it. In the second year of college, things began to go wrong, and I had a tough time getting through the end of it because the drinking, I stopped doing things. I'd drink and I just wouldn't do things. I lost my focus, I guess would be the best way to say it. And I wasn't compulsively drinking alcoholically or anything like that. But I'd lost the ability, I'd lost my drive or something when I drank. I just didn't care about anything anymore. So I had a summer working on a surveying crew up in the hills and drank a great deal every night and, you know, sometimes got sick in the morning and it just was going bad. And I started school in my second year. All of a sudden, my mother called and said my father was dead. Said he died, got up, fell over with a heart attack. And our economic situation just changed like that, bang. And I dropped out of school, came back, and I worked, and I drank, and I started to school, and I quit, and I drank, and I traveled. I went down into the southern part of Florida, and I came back up, and I went down into Mexico, and I came back up through the coast and across, and mother said he's trying to find himself. And I was drinking all the time, and my life was really in shambles, and I was angry, and this depression swept in over me. I didn't know anything about depression, but the liquor helped. And to save me, the thing that happened was called the Korean War. All of a sudden, I was swept up and thrown into the Army, and there was discipline, and everyone was marching together. They sent me down here to a place called Fort Bragg, and it wasn't too bad. And the next thing I knew, the old man called me in and said I should go to Officers Candidate School, and they sent me there. Then they sent me over to Korea, and 3.5 years later, I got out, went back to school, finished on the GI Bill, and married the girl across the street to settle down and be successful, right? And I got a good job, and I went to Des Moines, Iowa. And I had long since jettisoned my religion, and I had no foundation in life of that respect. It just wasn't necessary for me. The drinking started, business drinking, some social drinking. I shouldn't say started, it continued, it got worse. And I got into a couple of bad scrapes, and I really thought I had to quit. And I remember sitting one morning reading a paper, and somehow this little article about the pioneers of Ireland. And I said, well, this looks interesting, I'm Irish. I wrote away, and I got a pamphlet back from a priest in Philadelphia, and he said, pioneers are an organization which don't drink, and usually children get involved, and they take the pledge, and on special occasions, they wear a little badge on their lapel to indicate they belong to the pioneers. And he said, we don't have any chapters in Des Moines or Iowa, but be happy if you'd start one. And I looked at this thing, and I looked at that badge, and I said, I can't wear that badge. I mean, wearing that badge, walking down Grand Avenue in Des Moines, some guy said, hey, Franks, what's that badge? I said, that means I don't drink. I said, I can't tell anyone I don't drink. I might as well tell them I'm emasculated or something. You know, that's part of a male culture. And then it dawned on me, I could take that little pin and put it on the underside of my lapel, and I saw one of the brothers coming, I could flip it over, shake hands, and go on my way. Well, needless to say, I didn't do anything about my drinking. I was promoted. I was sent to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and in Des Moines, they had this thing called liquor by the drink, or you bought a bottle, and I bought a bottle. I would drink it all. Of course, I'd get messed up. Sometimes I'd check in on a business trip. I'd check in to Hotel A and wind up sleeping in Hotel B, and where's A, you know? The Milwaukee experience caused daily drinking. Now, it's available all over. There's a bar in every corner in Wisconsin, if you haven't been there. They say, what, Green Bay, Wisconsin is a drinking town with a football problem. And my first hospitalization came in Milwaukee. They put me in the hospital because I was drinking, and I was vomiting, and I was drinking, and I was vomiting, and I couldn't stop either one, and they put me in the hospital. I got out of the hospital and went for a couple of weeks without drinking, and I started again. I was one of those fortunate guys that had people around me protecting me. I had a woman that worked for me who was brilliant, and she handled the phone, and I got away for a long time. I was offered a job in Chicago, and I went in and talked to these people, and they said, God, you got a terrific track record. You got all the skills we need. But there's one thing we do. We always send all our people to talk to a psychiatrist before we hire them. And I said, great. So I went to this guy, and he talked to me for about 2.5 hours, and he said, you know, Frank, he said, real friendly guy, sneaky but friendly. He said, you know, you got all the skills and the experience to, and I'm going to recommend you for this job. He said, but I tell you what, here's a list of 3 psychiatrists in Milwaukee. He said, you're halfway around the bend. You ought to see one of these guys. And so I was flattered. You know, I thought, boy, I'm a real big shot. You know, everyone was getting into analysis, and I thought, wow, I should have been insulted. I should have cleaned up my life. So I started going to a shrink in Milwaukee, an Irish guy. I picked the one with the Irish name. I think he'd be sympathetic. And I didn't have that kind of money. I mean, even then, those guys were expensive. And I'd go every week, and we'd talk about things. And the closest we ever talked to real alcohol was how vermouth in a martini affects your bowel movements. And, you know, he kept saying, you know, talk to me. I'm probing. I'm probing. I said, man, you can't go any deeper than that. I said, you know. My wife would always say, Frank, if you could just find someone to talk to. And I said, I'm talking to the shrink. What do you want me to do? No, she said, I don't mean that. She said, you've got to talk to someone. And she begged me, and I finally relented, and I said, all right, all right. And I hadn't been in a church in years, but I called the local rectory. And I said, look, I got a problem. I said, it's very confidential and very private. I just can't share this with anybody. Oh, he said, I see. I think he figured I murdered someone or something. He said, we got a Jesuit here who's come back to see his family. He's going to be here for 10 years, and then he's going back to Far East. He said, he'll never be back in the United States again. Your secrets will be safe with him. So I met this guy. He was a big, beautiful man. He knew nothing about alcoholism. And we talked and talked, and he said, you've got to come back in the church, straighten out your life. And he said, that's your problem. He said, you've got a spiritual problem. He said, what you got to do is start going to church again regularly. And for 3 days, I got up early, went to Mass and communion. The fourth day, I got drunk, and I didn't go back into church for years. As luck will have it with alcoholics, I got another promotion. And I did some things brilliantly. I don't want to sound like it's braggadocio time, but I put some pretty good acts together. I made some terrible mistakes, but I never let people remember them very long. I told them how wonderful I was, Mr. Wonderful. Went into Pittsburgh, and I did the same act. I left my family in Milwaukee, went to Pittsburgh, got an apartment downtown, little icebox, put 3 bottles of vodka. I couldn't drink gin anymore. I figured it was the seasoning in gin, what's it called, that was killing me? The juniper. The juniper in the gin is what's tearing up my stomach. So I switched to vodka. Put 3 bottles of vodka, 2 boxes of cigars, and 1 lemon in the refrigerator, and started dancing around Pittsburgh. Now, I don't know whether you've ever been to Pittsburgh or not, but Pittsburgh is not a good town to drink in. Now, it's a shot in a beer town, and if you're raised there, you can get away with drinking for a good many years. But when you come in new, they got 3 rivers, the Allegheny, Monongahela, and the Ohio, and they got bridges across these. In fact, they got one bridge they call the Bridge to Nowhere, which hadn't been completed. It went halfway, and one guy went off that one night, even though they had boards blocking it. And they got tunnels they call tubes, and they go through the mountains. And I was lost all the time. I just couldn't get it. It was awful. I knew where my office was. And again, I needed a secretary. I hired a very bright woman, not pleasant to look at. Oh, was she brilliant. You know, she could type 150 words a minute, smoke a cigarette, talk on the telephone, and within no time, she'd memorized everything that was important to my job, and she protected me. And so I didn't get caught. My office was in New Jersey, my headquarters, so I was dancing around. And again, back into the hospital. And, you know, I could sense these doctors were getting a little fed up with me. This one doctor, really nice guy. And he said, I don't like guys like you. I said, what do you mean? Well, he said, you're making a living out there. But he said, you know, you're kind of destroying yourself. You shouldn't drink. He said, your liver's already hard. And he said, your stomach's a mess. He said, in fact, a lot of things you shouldn't eat. And he gave me a diet of stuff I shouldn't eat. And he said, you know, what really angers me, he said, look at my hands. He said, I've got rheumatoid arthritis. I spent my life becoming a surgeon. And he said, I had to give it all up and become an internist. And I get people like you. He said, disgusting. And I was kind of arrogant, and I said, well, the guy's got rheumatoid arthritis because he doesn't live right, you know. Later, I had a terrible thing happen. I was walking down a street in Pittsburgh, and I just crashed. I fell over. And they took me to the hospital and checked me out and let me go. And 3 weeks later, I'm not drunk, and I'm in a restaurant talking to some guys, and crash on the floor. So they took me back in, and this time they put me through all the tests. And the doctor said, how much do you drink? And I gave him a standard answer, you know, 2 beers, lightly, a little glass of wine before dinner. Never had any wine, hated wine. And he said, you know, he said, I think you're an epileptic. He said, we've given you all the brain tests, and they are negative, but he said, your behavior, he said, this crashing. Once I crashed in the Pittsburgh airport, I'm walking through the airport, running to catch a plane for New Jersey, boom, down. They carry me out to an ambulance, and I'm groggy, trying to figure out where I am, and this 300-pound Irish cop's on my chest with oxygen in my face, and he said, "You're going to make it, kid, just breathe." I couldn't breathe. The guy was sitting on my chest. And they took me to the Allegheny Hospital, and the doctor there said, "You know, you better stop burning the candle at both ends." You know, I was coming off a toot. And I said, "Ah, no." I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Kid stuff, I'll be fine." He said, "I'll be around a lot longer than you are." And that terrible thing happened. The poor guy fell out of a boat the following week and drowned in the Allegheny River. True story. Isn't that amazing? So I'm taking Dilantin, and it doesn't do anything for me. I'm still crashing. And my life is a shambles. And now I'm really worried about my job. I can no longer pull it off. And they're getting the winds back east that they've got some kind of an idiot out there, a fool, or whatever you might call him. And I'm really scared now, because I couldn't quit drinking, and I couldn't start to live. And my children didn't, they kind of avoided me. They were little bitty tots, three little girls. And once, one, I hugged one once, "Oh, God," she didn't say God, she said, "Oh, Daddy," she says, "You smell bad." You know. And that hurt. And my wife is showing signs that she's about ready to pull stakes. And this bothered me, and I felt guilt-ridden about it. And so one afternoon, I'd been out drinking for 3 days and come back to the office, and I had this habit of coming in late in the office, and I'd try and return phone calls. You know, you call U.S. Steel at 11 o'clock at night, nobody's there. What's the matter? Nobody. And she called and said she was going to have a little dinner with the children. She wanted me to come home, be sure and get home. And I did. I staggered in the back door about 5:30 at night. It was a hot Pittsburgh night, August. And I went in and sat down, just directly in and sat down on the table. And the children were there, and they were all dressed up, just beautiful. They had little dainty dresses on, and they start pounding the table. "We're going to have a party. Where's the food and all?" And my wife put this little salad down in front of me, tossed salad. In the old days, I just love salad. I do today, if you've watched me. I like salad and fruit, a lot of it. And I took one look at that lettuce, and I couldn't even imagine getting that lettuce down my throat. My hands are shaking. So she picked up the lettuce, and she put down a little Boston strip steak. And a little grease, you know, were popping off. It was sizzling. Oh, Lord, I couldn't touch that stuff. And I pushed it away. And I'm trying to think. You know, I had 1,000 excuses for getting out of the house in an emergency. And I, over and over again, and I always had one that would come right up. And I was thinking, I could feel the sweat trickling down my back. And I felt sick to my stomach. And I needed a drink. And she didn't. She'd take it out of the icebox as fast as I'd put it. I used to put vodka in the freezer. You put a bottle of vodka in the freezer, and you pull it out, and boom, boy, you make a martini out of one of those suckers with nothing but vodka in it, and it really hits home. So I'm trying to think of a way to get out, and I was going to tell her I needed a cigar, but I knew that she kept cigars in the icebox. She kept Dutch Masters and various kinds, and she had them in a mayonnaise jar, like a humidor. And you know, if I said, "I got to have a Dutch Master cigar, you know, that's what I need." And she'd go to the icebox and, "Here you are, son, here's your..." So I tried to think of a cigar, and I thought of a Have a Tampa wooden tip. And I hadn't seen one of those in 10 years. And said, so I told her I had to have a Have a Tampa wooden tip cigar because I had that wood in my mouth. I didn't want to taste the tobacco. And I gave her, and I went out the back door. And I don't know what happened that night. I was afoot. We lived in the city of Pittsburgh. And I was kicked out of several bars, I remember that. And it was early in the morning, and I think I was trying to get into a car, and I can't remember for sure, but about 10 o'clock I woke up in the back of a used car lot, and I had vomited, and there was blood with it down the front of my shirt and my trousers, and I was laying there in the oil and the gravel, one glass broken out. And I tried to push myself up against a block wall. Actually, it was brick, that old Pittsburgh red brick, and I tried to stand up, and I fell down again. And I started staggering around, and I knew I was going to die, and it was the end. I didn't want to live. Way out, and life was terrible. Debts were piling up. And I was only 300 yards from my house, and I couldn't even get home. And I'm crawling down the street, and I finally got back to the house, back through the kitchen. Everything was picked up, of course. The kids were kindergarten. I crawled up the stairs and crawled into bed and laid down, and my wife had gone out. She'd been calling the police and calling the hospitals because she knew I was sick anyway, and she thought I died somewhere under a rock. I don't know. And she came into the bedroom, and I'm laying in bed, and she had knitting. She used to try and keep her hands busy after those, you know, because I think she didn't want to strangle me. She'd knit, and she wouldn't talk. She'd just knit, and I always wonder how she did that. She'd keep looking at her knitting. And I looked at her, and again, I had 100 excuses for why these things happened. Now, basically, over the long haul, I hid my bottles out of town. I'd go out of town and get so bombed out, freaked out. I was supposed to be home on a Thursday, and I wouldn't get home till Saturday morning. And so she didn't know about the real bad parts. I'd wind up in a hotel that I didn't know where it was, and I had, my goodness, I could be in Chicago with keys to a fine room in the Palmer House Hotel, and I'd wind up in some dump down on Randolph. And you know, those dumps, you can always tell me. You wake up in the morning, you look around, the first thing you look for is there a little sink in the corner of the room? Because if there's a sink in the corner of the room, it means the bathroom's down the hall. I woke up in one of those one day, it may have been Dubuque or Kansas City, I don't know, and I looked and the little wash basin was there and I was sick and I had to go to the bathroom. And it was about 10 degrees above zero outside, and the snow was blowing against the window, and there was this huge radiator by the window that was radiating heat, and I was sweating, and I looked at that little sink, and the rotten wallpaper, and the rugs were all worn up, and I knew I could never make it down the hall, and I didn't even think I could make it to the sink, but I knew I was going to be there several hours, and I didn't want to mess up the sink and the floor, so I ran to the window, and I figured I'd lift up the window, and the window was frozen. I couldn't budge it. I turned and let go all over that radiator. It just cooked. And I couldn't get out of that room. I looked at my wife with one of my excuses. You know, I got some bad vermouth. The beer was green. I mixed my drinks. But instead, for some reason, which I don't even know today, I looked at her and I said, you know, Judith, I'm an alcoholic. I can't. I'm done. And she said, call AA. Now, I'd never had any 12-step calls on me. I'd never seen any AA literature. She had. She had read the stuff. She'd talked to the village priest. She'd done this and done that. And I called AA. Within a few hours, a guy called back, and he said, he had a deep, gravelly voice. He said, you called AA? Yeah. Your name Frank? Yeah. You name Frank Marion? Yeah. He said, my name's George. And George became my sponsor. And George said, can you walk? I said, well, yeah. I said, I don't want to go too far from the bathroom. I'm walk. And he said, I'll tell you what, he said, you come down, he said, if you can walk, he said, you come down and meet me tomorrow noon downtown. He said, I'm busy, but I said, I want you to come down. And I think he was testing me. George had lost the last three pigeons. They flew the coop. And everyone was kidding about him, George and his pigeons, in a friendly way. And so he said, I'll meet you at the William Penn Hotel in front of the men's bar. He said, I'll be wearing a black suit, a red tie, and a Panama hat. I said, oh, God, the men's bar. This guy's going to get me drunk. And I went down, and here's this guy, trim, about 55 years old, in a dark suit, tie, hat. And he grabbed me and took me down the basement where there's a big restaurant. I never even knew there was one down there. And I couldn't eat. I picked at it. And he told me a little bit about himself, and he told me about the fellowship. And he kept talking about the fellowship. I said, what's a fellowship? You know? And he's very gentle about it. He wasn't as tough as I thought he was. Well, George worked with me, and he got other men to work with me, and I went to meetings, and I went to meetings, and if George was very busy with his business career, and he would get other guys to take me to meetings, and he would take me and meet me, and my wife met him, and she thought he was a saint. And but he always was one jump ahead of me, and he seemed to know what I needed. And this one thing, you know, I said, George, what do you do when you bump into a guy, and he says, let's go have a drink, Frank, you know, or you're in a business meeting. They say, well, what are you drinking? Oh, he said, you just say, I'm not drinking today. Oh, I said, because he said, you just give it up one day at a time. I said, oh, well. And then another guy says, oh, you tell him you got a social disease and you're on biotics and antibiotics and you can drink and all these crazy things. And George called me, he says, hey, he said, there's a guy you ought to listen to. He said, he's down at Castle Shannon Group. He's going to speak tonight in the South Hills. So four of us went down there, and we got there late. That is, they'd already read the steps. And the room was crowded. It was packed, and there were guys just coming out of the steel mill, and some of them had hard hats, and there were some other guys getting ready to go in on the swing shift. And it was a pretty tough crowd. And this guy was walking around, and I wasn't sure who was going to speak. And then he came up, and he took his hard hat off, and oh, he's a huge man. He was an ugly guy. He had a big scar face, you know, from a bottle fight. And he was a tough guy. And I was standing in the back of the room with some others, and he just walked up that podium and said his name, and he looked around. I felt he was almost looking at me, you know. I just said, and he said, I don't drink. And I said, I never said you did, you know. And then he got a real attitude of humility or something that just floated through the room, and a guy told his story. And there was so much similarity in the way the culture, the being at it with his old man and the macho thing, and that all men drank, and it was, you were kind of a lightweight or a limperist if you didn't drink. And it was part of us. We're Irish, we drink, and you don't abuse it. If you can't handle it, you're no good, but you still drink. And that solved my problem. The next day I could go out and the guy says, let's have a drink. I don't drink. What's the big deal? I don't drink. I can't tell you what a relief that was. I don't drink. So what? Most people don't care whether you drink or not. They don't care. We were having lunch with some other guys, old-timers, and they were talking about the steps, and I'm listening, you know, and trying to learn this thing, and I made some what I thought was a brilliant comment, and George took me, he said, what'd you say? He said, what's the eighth step? I said, oh, God, I don't know, George. He said, what's the seventh, the sixth, fifth, fourth, third? He says, Frank, spend a year on the first step. He says, you'll know when you're ready. Spend a year on the first step. And one time we were talking, you know, and George is bringing me through this thing gently, and I was meeting so many people, and he says, get a book and write their names down. I couldn't remember anything. I started, and I still have that habit I carry, if you know it, I carry a notebook, write things down all the time. I started with George. He said, Frank, what's the most important step? I thought, and I said, I got him. Most important step, George? The 12th. Why do you say that? Well, if you got to the 12th, you're all done. He said, you fool. And then he started to explain. He called me meathead all the time. Because I had this theory that I could apply my mind and I could solve any problem. And I knew I was intense and I knew I was arrogant. And I knew if I applied my body and I applied my mind, I could do it. I could burn through high school in 3 years. I could do this. I knew, see, I was arrogant. But I was a little bit teachable. And I was going through all these emotional crises and trying to get my wife straightened out. You know how that is. And I went to George once and I said, you know, I don't know if I can go any further, George. I'm really cracking up. And I was talking a lot more tearful than I am now. And George looked at me and he said, oh, he said, you're one of those rarely guys. He said, what do you mean rarely guy? He says, you know, like it says in the book, rarely have we seen a person fail. He said, you're either dishonest or you're psychotic. And I said, "You, me, psychotic?" I was a little dishonest, but I wasn't psychotic. So the months went by and the things began to straighten out. A company called from New Jersey. I got another job that was really great, and I was transferred to Chicago. And I went 2 years, a little over two, before I took the fourth and fifth, which was just fine for me. That was my speed. And later George died, and I got a sponsor out in New Jersey. And it worked very well for me, and it still does. And so I want to conclude with a few more things about this third step that I feel. I think I've made it clear that I think it's my favorite step. I think when a guy's new in a program, he's got to build up to it. You just can't go boom, 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 I'm on the third. Now I got to find a guy, make a list. Doesn't work that way. At least it didn't for me. You know, there was an interesting thing that happened in 1939. They were ready to publish the big book, and they were excited about it, and there was a question. They did not know whether they should include the words, "as I understand him, God as I understand him," in the third and the 11th step. And there were some that did not want to do it because they said, "There's one God, you put that in there, you're going to have a million gods and you're going to make every church in the country upset because you're preaching idolatry, blah, 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 blah." And there was another group that wanted to say in the 7th step, where we humbly ask, they wanted to insert the words, "on your knees," or "on our knees." And so they finally compromised, and they said, "We won't put the on our knees things in, but we will put in, as I understand him," or "as I understood him," or "as we understood him." And that is so important to me, because in all the churching I'd had, I never got a concept of God, because it always had to come out of a book, or it had to come from a preacher or a priest, and it was never here. I never understood what God was. To me, it was Montana. It was the open sky. It was the beautiful meadowlark in the morning. And once I grasped that principle that I could start talking to God as I understand, then it made sense. And I really think you have to get there. It's like I can turn my life over to a God I understand, like the guy with the racehorse. Now, there's another interesting thing. We say a prayer at the end of an AA meeting, and we start with an AA meeting prayer, the Serenity Prayer. And I have strong feelings about what goes on between those two prayers. And I don't like profanity in a meeting. Now, I hear it from young people, and I don't go up and shake my fist at them. And I just don't think it belongs there, given our culture. But the prayer we say at the end, the third petition in that prayer, "Give us this day our daily bread." To me, that's another statement of the third step. We say, "Give." Give. And that's humbling. That's very humbling, if you think about it. We're saying, "Give to somebody who is our life sustainer. I am dependent upon you. Give." And we say, "us." And if you notice the steps, they're written in the "us" and the "we." We're interconnected. All of us in this room are interconnected. And we say, "this day, our daily." This day. We're only asking for one day at a time. What else do you want? That's beautiful. One day. I never understood the one day concept until George explained it to me. That's a wonderful way to live. You live a lifetime in one day. And you know that word "daily" occurs only once in the New Testament. That word only is once the scholars have found it. And bread, of course, can be anything, life-sustaining, food. We used to call bread money, money bread. I would like to leave you with this thought. We lost a real good AA a few months ago in Memphis. He's a good friend of mine, a terrific AA, Gene B. I talked to him right after he'd gotten his results back, and he had cancer, and he knew it was going to be the end. His percentages of making it were very, very small, and he wasn't bitter. And he said, I'm where God wants me to be. And he continued to go to AA meetings as long as he could walk. And when he couldn't walk anymore, he would talk to guys on the phone. And Gene had a plaque in his den at home. And the plaque said, there's nothing you can do to make God love you more. There's nothing you can do to make God love you less. God just loves you. Thank you for being with me this morning.